Welcome to this podcast from Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club of California, by and for people in their 20s and 30s with a mission to inspire debate around civic issues. This podcast is made possible through support from the members of Inforum and the Commonwealth Club. To learn more about events or membership, visit us online at commonwealthclub.org/inforum or join us on Facebook, MySpace, and LinkedIn.
Hello, good evening. Thanks, Caroline. Tonight, we are at the tonight's meeting of Inform. It's a division of the Commonwealth Club by and for people in their 20s and 30s with a mission to inspire debate on civic issues. You can find the Commonwealth Club online at commonwealthclub.org/inform. I'm Jane Kay, environment writer of the San Francisco Chronicle. Tonight for our panel, Battling for the Environment, Stories from the Frontline, we brought together a panel of authors whose works have focused on the environment. The program is being co-presented by LitQuake 2008, and tonight we host. We're going to be talking, our five writers have been to the front lines. Thomas Costigan takes us to some of the most environmentally troubled spots on Earth and is simply titled, You Are Here. Sebastian Copeland captures heart-stopping photographs of Antarctica and sends an SOS back home to the rest of the world in Antarctica, The Global Warning, and Antarctica, A Call to Action. Claire Hope Cummings writes about the misguided technology of genetically modifying plants and gives us troubling insights into the future of seeds in her incredibly well-researched book, Uncertain Peril. Gerrymander, an intellectual force in the environmental movement, writes Paradigm Wars. It's an investigation of the effects of globalization, and he finds resistance among indigenous peoples to despoiling of their resources. Christy Matheson writes a little book called Green Chic, and it's directed at us, the people making decisions every moment of every day on whether or not to get in the car, what to buy, how to light our houses, and wash our clothes. Perhaps it's part of the definition of an environmentalist, but all of these writers, no matter what they've found in their travels, share at least some optimism that maybe it's not too late. Maybe we can still turn it around, at least enough to save some of the planet as we know it. Tonight, we're going to start with Sebastian. Your photographs are so unbelievably beautiful. I hope all of you look at his book, Antarctica, really. I've really never seen anything like them. And you experienced natural climate systems out of whack. Can you actually see changes taking place in Antarctica because of warming oceans and atmospheres? What's it like there?
Well, it would be... thank you, Jane, by the way, for the kind words. But it would be inaccurate to say that in photographs from visiting Antarctica on one or two or three trips that you can actually record visually what is going on. You'd have to do scientific photographs and take the same image over and over again over the course of many, many years, as you do with glaciers, receding glaciers and whatnot. So my objective was not specifically to record climate change in photographs. It was more to celebrate the natural environment in Antarctica and to bring it in people's homes, because as the world is shrinking, as our ability to travel farther and quicker has entered our collective consciousness, we're actually a lot closer to Antarctica, and by virtue of the activities that we're perpetuating from thousands of miles away, we're having a profound impact on this environment. So I had planned to photograph Antarctica for on a celebratory basis, and then to add the scientific research and the text included to educate people on what is going on over there. But I did have one experience, which on my first trip there, we went to a place called Port Foyne, which is Antarctica used to be a whaling environment for many, many years at the turn of the last century. And there's an area that has called Port Foyne, which has a lot of human waste in the form of barrels and all kinds of steel and whatnot, moors and whatnot. And these wooden barrels, were covered in ice for most of the last century. And when I went on my first trip, they had been uncovered primarily from ice or snow and whatnot, but they were still filled with ice inside of them. And on my last trip there 2 years later, I went, and you could literally lift any one of these barrels, and they were now open to decay and whatnot. So that was on a sort of, you know, visceral level. That was the one most poignant indication of how warm it had gotten in that short amount of time.
Thank you. Tom, I wanted to talk about your book. You took us to Amazon jungles, which you call nature's oxygen factory, to Lifan City, China, one of the most polluted places on the planet, Shishmaref Village in Alaska, where people are moving ahead of the rising ocean. In Borneo, you showed us forests clear-cut and scraped and rivers dammed and dynamited, animals pushed off the land. Take Borneo, for example. What can possibly turn this around? I mean, talk about devastating Eden.
Mm. Well, thank you. Thank you, Jane. And I just want to thank my panelists. I got a little bit of time to spend with them beforehand. I want to thank Litquake for giving me that opportunity. They've done such great work, and I just appreciate being here. The most amazing thing is that sort of sense of community that just this small group of us had in the room back there talking about these issues, and then going out and experiencing it firsthand and seeing exactly what our effect is all around the world. A little thing like palm oil, for example, that's in our toothpaste and pastries and also in our potato chips and French fries, that type of thing. We don't even know about it, but it's staring at us right in the face on many soaps. And that is ravaging the lowland forests of Borneo, displacing many species to the brink of extinction. And it's also contributing to deforestation. Deforestation is the second biggest cause of climate change besides fossil fuel burning. That, in turn, creates sea level rise, much like what Sebastian was talking about. So it's not just in Antarctica or just in the Arctic that we're seeing sea level rise and the contributors of it. We can see it down by the tropics as well. So it's really fascinating to go there and just try and understand and see the ramifications of what you do in the morning, just after you get up, and then see that effect a world away and try and understand what those images mean. So the book really puts images with actions. And I think the more we start to think about that, those iconic images of the polar bears drowning, and attach those and connect those with the turning on of our light switch and that getting of energy from coal plants and that fossil fuel being burned and that adding and contributing to carbon emissions. I think once we start to connect all of these dots in this wonderful butterfly effect way, we can then shift it and redirect those ripples to the betterment of the planet rather than for its destruction.
Well, Tom, I mean, your book could be used in an environmental reporting class because you picked the site that would express the problem, and then you take it all back home to Santa Monica and show how you try to live to reflect what you saw. Claire, excuse me.
Okay, no, I just didn't know if you wanted to respond.
I'm sorry.
So shut up. I was going to say yes.
Claire, you in your book, Uncertain Peril, you set the stage in the beginning at this meeting at Asilomar in 1975, where biotech scientists are assembled, and they're talking about the great promise of what they can give, and they agree that they should pretty much regulate themselves, and that they should take on the role of determining U.S. policy in regard to the future of genetic engineering. And can you tell us how, in a way, this has played out in the farm fields?
Thank you. Thanks, Jane, and thanks to Litquake, and hello, everyone. The Asilomar meeting in 1975 set the stage for the deregulation of this particular technology, and we're hearing that word a lot today, and it's just as disastrous. In other words, deregulation of the financial markets have been disastrous financially for us now. That's very much on our mind. You can use the same thinking to understand the effect on the environment from the deregulation of certain technologies. And in particular, my book is about genetic engineering technology, and it's also about the kind of technology that we need now, given global warming, given the things that the other speakers have already mentioned about the loss of a species and other threats to the environment. One of them is seeds, and seeds, about 75% of the genetic diversity that we've always relied on. Seeds are the regenerative capacity of the planet. They not only keep the plant systems alive, they provide us with oxygen, they keep us alive, because our food systems are based in seeds. And so I chose seeds to tell the stories of this technology and the changes to technology. And I took the title Uncertain Peril from something that James Watson said when he was referring to that Asilomar conference. And he said that this technology had within it certain promise and uncertain peril. And he said, hey, we're just going to go. We scientists, we know what we're doing. We're going to go with a certain promise. And they basically, from then on, just disregarded the uncertain peril. And they went into government regulations as soon as Monsanto got its hands on this technology and started to use it for agriculture. They went to the White House and they made a deal with George I, who was vice president then under Reagan. And this was the era of deregulation. And they said, basically, biotechnology as used in this context would not be regulated. As a result, we have widespread contamination in the environment. We have super weeds. We have the food you're eating is full of genetically modified organisms or GMOs. And you don't know that because there are no labels. There are no labels in this country because of this deregulation. So a lot of the political and farm effects, the impacts on farmers and farm economy, a lot of the things that we can discuss about this technology came out of this idea, which I call the techno-elites, that people can decide for themselves whether or not what they're doing is safe. And rather than have government agencies, which we have come to hope, at least, have a role in protecting health and safety.
Thank you. Jerry, in your most recent book, you've written several wonderful books. In your most recent one, Paradigm Wars, you teamed up with an IGRET leader from the Philippines, and together and with your team of thinkers, you have examined indigenous movements around the world. Do you see any progress and hope in people resisting some global changes that might harm their resources?
Yes. Good evening, and thank you, Jane, and very happy to be here among you all as well. Well, I've been writing mainly about globalization issues for quite a while, and this book, Paradigm Wars, is the fourth, I think, in that series. And it deals with the central problems that globalization creates, which is the tremendous overuse of planetary resources, the complete overconsumption of the Earth as a raw material for continued development and economic growth and capitalist enterprise. And the planet is now seriously suffering from resource shortages, including to some of the most basic resources that we need to even continue to live as we have till now. Of course, the big news goes to about oil and gas, but there's also forests and key minerals and arable soil and fish in the seas and genetic diversity and medicinal plants, and we heard something about it from Tom and also Claire. The tragedy for indigenous people is that they, because of the way they have managed to live over the centuries and over millennia, in fact, have lived in such a manner that the most of the resources on their own lands are still there. They have lived in a manner in which resources are still sustained. They're not into shipping all their trees over to the United States to build stuff with, or to mining all the coltan that may be in the ground on their lands in order to build cell phones. So the tragedy of that is that right now in the global shortage of resources, about 50%, it's estimated, of the remaining resources of the world are on indigenous lands, making them both, we should celebrate that they have lived in such a way that they have retained resources in that way, but it also makes them the greatest target on the planet for continued corporate intervention and invasion, and this is extremely serious. But as you asked, they are very well organized now. They have unified in many, many ways to fight this, and probably the greatest resistance on the planet. It's not universally true, but I think in general you could say that the greatest resistance on the planet to the globalization model is among indigenous peoples of the world. And the most recent victory that they had was the passage of the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People, which is a very brilliant, fantastic document that hasn't been as well publicized as it really needs to be, but which gives them the right, basically, to resist continued resource invasions. And they are already using it with some degree of success. So I think there's lots of optimism now that they're going to be able to resist, at least to some extent, against the juggernaut that they've been dealing with.
Thank you. Thank you, Jerry. Christy, you are our nuts and bolts. In your book, Green Chic, you help sort out plastics and end up by saying, don't use it. You figured out which fluorescents give white light, which give yellow, and how much wattage you need to light different kinds of rooms. You give green advice on dining and drinking, transportation, parties, and beauty care. What part of the book was the hardest to write?
Well, thanks, Jane, and thanks to all the other panelists. It's nice to be here with you. The hardest part to write, probably the parts that I was writing really late at night when I was tired. I think because I dealt with topics throughout the book that were all very personal to me, just things that I dealt with on a daily basis, you know, as you said, dining and drinking, maybe too much drinking, beauty care, travel, transportation. I think, you know, there was no particular section that was harder to write than any other, just because it was all so real and so tangible.
Well, where was it hardest to find information where you had to dig to get your own?
Oh, sure.
What
I was going to say is I think, you know, telling my personal stories about trying everything, because I did try everything that I write about in the book. I don't just say, recycle your plastics or try this or try that. I actually did it. I spent a year doing it, and I write about that. So those stories were easy to tell. What was a little bit harder to do was to take the information, the research. You know, Thomas was talking about palm oil and how it's, you know, it's this complicated thing that's in everything, and we don't really know much about it. You know, it's telling stories about things like that, like vitamins, you know, when you have some foods that are enhanced with vitamins. We don't really think about it. We eat those foods all the time, probably. But, you know, there's a lot of energy. There's a lot of chemicals that go into making that. And so it's sort of telling those stories, explaining the science and the data with that and with everything else in a way that was readable and sort of went along with the personal tone of the book. Because I think it's so important for people to understand why they're making changes and why we have to live green. So just sort of explaining that in a way that was fun could be a challenge.
Thanks. Tom, would you talk about the palm oil situation, and as U.S. consumers, how should we be responding to it?
Well, I think there's been a number of issues that got brought up here that bring us back to the same initial response, and that's the labeling of food products. And getting that information, I think, is so, so important. We had legislation passed this year, and we're starting to see that spill out into grocery stores. So you'll see on different food groups now where they come from and their countries of origin. They haven't gone to the extent of the GMO part of it yet, which hopefully they will. But I think getting that right type of information is so, so useful so people can make an educated choice. And when you start to look at the choices that we're given, we're not able to make educated choices because who knew about palm oil?
But what's really the right hard thing? What's the right thing?
So the way to actually do the research on it, that's where it gets really hard, because there is palm oil that is farmed sustainably and that is helping out the indigenous communities there. And the trick is, if we just put a ban on, say, palm oil, then these communities would grow rubber or rice, or you probably know this, Jerry, they'd grow something else and just exploit the land even more. So the way to do it is to take a look at the manufacturer, decide that, and look at the ingredients, see what's in there, and then go to the Palm Oil Sustainability Council, there is one out there, and see who's a member of it, and then make an educated decision from that. But it's not easy, and I want to put that out there for everything. There's no real easy choice here. It's really hard to do the homework, and that's where we need a little more support from the business community and hopefully from the government to help us out.
Thank you. Tom, would you tell us what the problem is in the countries where palm trees are grown for commercial oil?
Well, palm oil is the second most edible food besides soy that's exploited and shipped out all around the world. So in places like Borneo, this is a big problem because they're just chopping down the trees to make money. And they take this and they turn it into an oil via various manufacturing processes, and they ship it out to us. And not only does that lead to global warming because of deforestation issues, it's also pushing a lot of, as I mentioned before, the species there. Borneo is the most species-rich place on Earth. There are tigers and monkeys and orangutans and elephants, and it's just beautiful. It's a virtual Eden. And when you go there and experience it and you hike out into these logging places, it's really beautiful. But then you see the destruction, and that's really, really sad to see. So the only way to stop it, I guess, you know, to answer the question is to just make educated decisions about where your products come from.
Thank you. Claire, I wanted to ask you, your book it's incredibly well-researched, has a great index. Anyone needing to do research can just look at Claire's book. It's a big help. Now, one of the biggest problems with genetically modified plants is that pollen can blow around and contaminate wild plants and hybridized crops that we depend on. How much of this is happening? Can you talk to this about the contamination? And really, is it too late?
Is what too late?
Is there so much modified seed in our canola, our soy, our corn, that we cannot get clean crops?
I think that's a big concern for a lot of people. One of the reasons I wrote the book the way I did was because I'm a journalist, and as a lawyer, I want to make sure that we had good, credible, accurate information and good science, because I have found in covering this topic for 15 years, science is actually on the side of people who want to farm sustainably and to have food that's safe and healthy. And I talked earlier, your first question, about the science of... some of it is the best science that money can buy. A lot of research that goes into the contamination and the cross-pollination and some of these questions is coming out of other countries, because this country does not require the companies who make these products to test them in the field. The USDA actually, there have been many, many, you know, like 8,000 different permits issued for different crops, and they've all just been okayed with no questions. There's been one good piece of news recently. The Center for Food Safety brought a lawsuit on Roundup Ready alfalfa about I would say 85% of GMOs that are, you mentioned soy, Tom, are Roundup Ready, and 99% of those are Monsanto's Roundup Ready soy. So they've been coming out with Roundup Ready everything, believe me. Your Halloween candy next year could be coming out of with using Roundup Ready sugar beets. So Hershey's and Mars might be using Roundup in their food. So I'm getting to how it gets into our food as much to the environment. But I just want to say that that the court just decided to require environmental impact studies for the U.S. for the first time. And these crops have been out there since 1994. In the environment, widespread pollution of the conventional seed supply. So farmers who are planting conventional crops are inadvertently planting GMOs. Our foods, about 80% of the foods you eat in the grocery store, are the processed foods that contain soy, canola, cottonseed oil, or corn, have GMOs in them. In the environment, again, we have widespread contamination from those same crops that that I mentioned before.
Okay, thank you. Jerry, I wanted to talk to you. This is a particular moment for your message because you've been saying for quite a long time that economic growth and expansion is not what we need for a healthy economy. And now we're seeing problems, and do you relate this to resource consumption? Could you expand on that?
Yes. Well, of course, everyone's freaking out right now because economic growth is directly threatened. You know, in the current system, if you get a decline in growth rate from 2% to 1%, people lose their homes. Banks go belly up. People lose jobs, corporations are threatened. It's a very serious economic crisis. But in order to sustain that kind of that constant, never-ending growth, I mean, the system that we have now is based on never-ending, always continuing economic, always growing use of resources, as well as always growing markets and always growing supplies of cheap labor. And right now we have the greatest ecological crisis probably ever in climate change and what's called peak oil, which is to say that we're running out of inexpensive oil and inexpensive fuels, as well as the resource depletions that I mentioned. And that crisis is coming right up against the financial crisis, and between the two of them, I think the era of growth is ending. And it's going to be very, very important for people to recognize that some other way of organizing economic activity is going to be required, and soon. And I think that's the part of the discussion that's completely left out of the mainstream discussion of this economic crisis. I don't think that we're going to see much of a recovery in our lifetime. There's just not enough resources to fuel it. There's just there's not enough cheap labor that wants to keep doing this as cheaply as they've been. Markets are sometimes saturated, but the main problem is the resource crisis, and I do believe that the economic model that we're currently living in is not going to be viable for much longer, and the whole idea of continued non-ending economic growth is preposterous on a finite planet. It's just an anomaly. That worked okay in the late 1900s, in a time when there was abundant resources and they could be exploited and very, very rapidly, and they were exploited very, very rapidly, and then you had high rates of growth. That period is over. We don't have that anymore. Oil is short. I mentioned some of these are short, and so the main goal of our work in the next few years really, I think, needs to be, you know, what is Plan B? You know, let's get busy and organize the ingredients of a sustainable system that can take care of people at a decent level, at an equitable level throughout the world, and give up these fantasies of never-ending growth and wealth accumulation as the be-all and end-all of a system.
Well, we have, you know, of course, Lester Brown talks about Plan B, and there are many thinkers around the world. But how does one move this into the main thrust? Why is it always on the margins, and what would make that change?
Are you speaking?
Yes, I am.
Say more?
Sorry.
How to do it?
How to do it?
Well, with difficulty, I think, but it's a necessity. In my view, it's necessary to start talking about the realities of the moment, and that the assumption of that life should be lived according to the goal of gathering more stuff and gathering more personal wealth is, first of all, not really making people happy, judging by the degree of drug use and pharmaceutical use, which is zooming right now. And it's also ridiculous. It just can't happen on a planet that's running out of resources at the current rate. You can introduce technologies which will slow down some of that, but the technological solutions to this problem, like in energy field, for example, there's no way that any of the alternative energy systems can feed this machine at the rate that it would need to sustain itself at this level. So instead of growth, we're going to get what's called powering down. This society is going to deflate. In my view, I don't see any way around that, and we just have to start talking about it openly. I mean, I think I've been thinking lately of a book that is basically called "Is Capitalism Soon Over?" And what do we then do about it? And let's organize in some other manner so that sustainability is the goal rather than individual wealth, personal profit, corporate growth, and commodity consumption.
Can I comment on that,
please? Sebastian as well, because
I'll make it really quick because I just want to follow up on Jerry's point. You know, I think we've really been living in the economics of scarcity and the fear that that engenders. And I think that the abundance and the resilience of the natural world is something that indigenous communities, I was going to ask Jerry to expound on that, but I'll just make the quick comment that the last half of my book really explores these models for producing crops, for instance, instead of having them come out of the laboratory, having the farmers and indigenous communities working in place to produce adaptable crops, things like that. So I think there are a lot of models in indigenous communities and in traditional farming communities that can help us come out of this crisis and farm in a way that produces energy as well as food and community. And so I think an argument could be made that there's a lot of environmental benefits to the economic crisis that we're in.
I think one of the elements as well that's, you know, that has to be considered, one of the dark beasts in the closet is population demographics. I mean, we live within a finite environment. The Earth is a finite sphere, and we're multiplying and expanding as a population in ways that are completely unsustainable. We talked about what happened in the 19th century. Well, we had less than 1.5 billion people then. We're peaking at 6.6 billion today, and there is a definite ceiling to what kind of population demographic can be sustained by this planet. If you believe the World Wildlife Fund, the Earth will not be able to regenerate more than 50% of our needs within the mid-century for the mid-21st century. So that's really one of the key ingredients as well that we have to consider in terms of our economic expansion and in the models that have been, as Jerry was mentioning earlier, that have been the foundation of our systems, which is an ever-expanding economic model that is constantly essentially preying on more population and more expansion. The problem, of course, is that we live within that finite space, and if you believe James Lovelock, for instance, and the Gaia theory, the basic sort of feeling that, you know, meaning that the Earth is a self-regulating organism, and that essentially it's shaking off whatever virus or whatever antagonistic organism is infecting it, you have to consider that, you know, we have the possibility as a human species to to really overcome that limitation because of our conscience and because of our intellect and because of our resources and our capabilities. But if we are simply like cattle following a model that is destroying us, then the reality is our days are counted. And Stephen Hawking, amongst others, doesn't believe that humans have a future on this planet outside of space expansion.
You made a statement in your book, Tom, and you started your trip around the world, or at least your book in Jerusalem, and you write, we're not only losing our future, but we're also losing our past. And what did you mean by that?
Well, I wanted to go back to showcasing how the polar bears are drowning and connecting to the light switch, so it just makes sense that I'd start in Jerusalem. But I wanted to do that because I wanted to showcase that the world monuments are decaying at a faster rate in history because of climate change. So we're really losing our sense of culture and history as people. And in order to progress forward, we have to rely on history to make educated decisions. And if we're not making educated decisions on what's going on now, or in the recent past, I really don't know what base to go from. So I think we can learn a lot of lessons from that. And you see in Jerusalem, which has the Western Wall, the Dome of the Rock, and all of those images and sites of Christ, 50% of the world's population pray to those images, so they're familiar. And that becomes sticky when you start to say, those may go away.
Now, Christy, I wanted to ask you, in your book, you dedicate it to your sister, and it's very breezy. It's almost like a letter to your sister. And I'm wondering, I think we're all learning that it's important that young people hear these things. And in your book, you lay out the environmental problems when you drink a soda and you throw it away. You lay out the problems when you buy a bottle of water and throw it away. Have you ever thought of trying to get your book into, you know, high school libraries or talking to really young people?
I think it could be a valuable resource for a younger generation of readers and would-be environmentalists, because it is breezy, as you say, and it's fairly easy to read. You know, it mentions a vibrator at one point, so I don't know that high school libraries necessarily want to have it on their shelves. But at the same time, I know that, my husband told me that he works with someone in Maine whose daughter is, I think, 10 years old, and her teacher was talking to them about the book and saying, you know, I read this book, and I think, you know, it's something that you all could read. And so this 10-year-old put it on her wish list on Amazon, which was kind of nice. So I think it does speak to a younger audience. And I think that's an important place to start, you know, getting back to the things that Jerry was saying and that what Sebastian was saying. You know, I think at the consumer level, there really needs to be a total shift in mindset if we're going to change the way that we're consuming and the way that we're just this constant need for more stuff, more things, which don't ultimately make us happy. And I think one way to make those changes to mindset, the mindset of the population, is to start with people who are a lot younger. So, you know, I hope they read it.
Well, Sebastian, you've had to try to reach people through Green Cross. You're on the board of directors of the U.S. branch. And in fact, you've worked with celebrities, right, to try to spread the environmental message. How is that going?
Well, it's getting better. It's getting better than it was. I mean, I like to say that we're out of the tree hugging business as far as environmentalists, and that's a big progress. 5 years ago, it wasn't uncommon for people to draw a complete blank when you mentioned global warming. People would have ideas of sort of long, lazy summers and milder winters, and it didn't sound so bad. So today, luckily, you watched the presidential debate, and we're talking about tide energy and solar and wind, and those have become common parlance issues. So Having celebrities as a means to advocate is, of course, you know, capitalizing on the fame and the fact that in one form or another, notoriety gives you a role model quality to many people. It does anyhow. Mm-hmm. So, but you know, celebrities. Let's not get sort of sidetracked in the sense that they are just celebrities. They're human beings, and the ones who we work with are people who care and understand the fact that they've got a reach in that respect.
And who are some of the people who have been the most hardworking environmentalists that we might know of?
Well, I think at the top of that list you'd have, you know, if we name names, we've got Robert Redford and Leonardo DiCaprio. Leo's been extremely committed for a guy his age. But many of them are great. You know, Brad Pitt, we've done a lot of work with Brad Pitt, and Orlando Bloom has been good to us as well. And Salma Hayek's been really engaged as well. There's a long list of great celebrities who are doing good things, and then a long list of just not so celebrity-driven people who are doing even greater things. And, you know, the panel here, although I consider you guys celebrities as well in your own right, but you know, the point I'm making is that every people has a different purpose, and celebrities are a great mouthpiece. They reach millions so that the work of these great people get heard mm-hmm. through the mouth of these celebrity people. Mm-hmm.
I think right now many of us are thinking about food, what goes into our bodies. And in Claire's book, she's writing, the right to choose what we eat and to know what is in our food is a fundamental human freedom. And you all have talked about the problems of the failure to label. And back to your book about genetically engineered plants, do you think that there is any kind of movement in the U.S. to call for labeling? And could you tell about the passage of the law, signing of the law by Schwarzenegger in California?
Yeah, I can briefly do that. I just want to say I was
a
government.
I'm so sorry, Claire. Before I do that, I just want to say that people who have questions should probably start lining up, because we're going to start our question period in about 5 minutes, and the microphone is there. I'm sorry, Claire.
That's all right. I was a government lawyer in the 1980s, and so I thought perhaps, you know, I had hopes that the government would have a role in this technology. But as I explained earlier, it does not. Both presidential candidates have said that they would support labeling of this, but this is just the beginning of the real information that we need about the changes that are being made, because the products that are on the market now are just the very beginning. Everything you can imagine is being genetically engineered and patented, and every kind of idea from fish in your strawberries to, you know, just about everything you can imagine. Plants with human genes, plants with drugs and vaccines are getting in there. And as I said before, contamination is a real problem. You know, my book actually is, you mentioned a lot of the people here talked about different places in the world. And my book begins in Iraq and talks about, I want to just talk about the fundamental freedom. Because to me, one of the definitions of democracy is that we have the right to know what's in our food and the right to choose what to eat, both culturally and just as a matter of human rights. And when we invaded Iraq, we destroyed all of the seed and the seed banks, and the Iraqi farmers had been saving their own seeds. When we invaded in 2003, I begin the book with this, we destroyed all of that. And these are the great seeds of Mesopotamia, the wheats and the lentils and the peas and some of these other things. So our industrial agriculture has been a major cause of global warming and a major cause of the destruction of the genetic diversity that we rely on for our food supply. So as these things are destroyed through chemicals or genetics, we lose the nutritional capacity as well as the resilience and the adaptability of our food system. Now, one of the things that happens in the books, I talk about patenting, has been the corporate enforcement of patents against farmers. Even when farms are contaminated inadvertently with GMOs, these farmers have been sued, and I talk about thousands of cases. It's a great tragedy. the good news is California now has just passed a law, and Schwarzenegger signed it, saying to protect farmers who have not planted genetically modified organisms. And there's not a lot of GMO agriculture in California. If you want more information on that or on the new bill, go to CalGE Free or Google something like that. It was AB 541, and now farmers are protected if their fields are contaminated against being sued by these corporations. So it's a good step forward, like the lawsuits I mentioned and the other regulatory and the labeling efforts that are going on. Dennis Kucinich has been a great proponent of that in Congress. Actually, I would have to say, in my travels and speaking on this issue, I think the tide is turning.
Well, thank you so much. Thanks to all the members of our panel. We're going to start taking questions soon, but I'd like to remind our audience that this is the Commonwealth Club's Inforum program, and tonight we're hosting Battling for the Environment, Stories from the Front Lines. I'm Jane Kay of the San Francisco Chronicle, and I'm here with Jerry Mander, founder of the International Forum of Globalization, senior fellow at Public Media Center, and co-editor of the book, The Case Against the Global Economy and For a Turn Toward Local. Tom Costigan, author, you are here, exposing the vital link between what we do and what that does to our planet. Co-author of the best-selling Green Book. Claire Hope Cummings is a lawyer and author, a farmer, an environmentalist, a mother.
And grandmother.
And grandmother. author of Uncertain Peril, Genetic Engineering, and the Future of Seeds. And Christy Matheson, author, writer, magazine writer, appearing on television and radio segments on green living, and her new book, Green Chic. Sebastian Copeland, author, photographer, activist, lecturer, author of Antarctica, The Global Warning, and also Antarctica, Call to Action, member of the board of directors of Global Green USA, which is the U.S. branch of Green Cross. Thank you. And let's go to the audience for questions.
Hi, my name is Tierra Forte. You actually mentioned my company, Del Forte Denim, in your book, Christy, so thank you for that. My question is actually for Jerry. You mentioned that, and I think most people, and certainly most people in this room, agree that society as it works now is not sustainable, and we're going to have to come up with a new way of functioning and being. Do you see that as something that we do voluntarily, or do you think we're looking at kind of a complete breakdown and rebuilding?
Well, that's the question. Let's hope it's voluntarily, and let's hope it's done in an orderly manner. A lot of people predict that that the powers that be will continue to try to sustain this model, continue making the same choices which are leading to the problems that we're now facing, and that eventually there'll just be a total collapse and the introduction of authoritarianism to, greater authoritarianism than at present, in order to just keep people fed or just keep the system orderly in some way. The people I hang around with and everybody at this table, I'm positive, would say that there are plenty of options between now and such a thing as that, and that it's up to all of us to be sure that we make it known that we want to achieve a sustainable system based on other principles besides never-ending economic growth and personal accumulation of wealth and commodities as the primary goals of life, and also that it'll be a good thing. It's made to seem, when anybody discusses this, as though it's going to be a bad thing. I can think back. I'm old enough to remember World War II. And I remember what happened in the middle of that war. We had massive rationing of things, and it was hard to get food and hard to get stuff. And suddenly my mother, who had never grown anything in her life, was in the backyard. And the backyard turned into a little farm. And we had tons of food right in our own backyard. And pretty soon all the neighbors had these gardens that were all connected up. And there was a whole victory garden movement that developed at that time. That's going to start happening now here, too, I think. And I think it's a good thing. I don't think it's a bad thing. You get back in touch with the soil, and you also get in touch with the limits of the earth. And that's that kind of reality is what's necessary. Now, unfortunately, the political model that we now have doesn't really include that. If a presidential candidate starts talking about steady state economics or no growth economics, they wouldn't last very long in campaigning. So it's really up to the public and the NGO movement and artists and writers and so on to build an environment where that kind of consciousness can develop more rapidly. But it's not a choice. I mean, I think that's, you know, I'm totally convinced that the current model is not sustainable, and it can be propped up for a while, but it can't really go on for much longer, and that it's going to be necessary to come to grips with that, and that we have to find a way to do it in such a manner that it is satisfying and people, you know, can live well. They can't live excessively, but there's enough. If we achieve levels of what we call sufficiency rather than indulgence and overconsumption, that we can achieve some degree of equity and sustainability at the same time. So it's going to be, the future is not that bright unless we can make those kinds of switches to self-sustaining systems, local systems. Localization is a very important part of this. The globalization model is entirely wasteful and non-sustainable, but I've talked too long. I'm sure other panelists will have
to. Thank you. Thank you, Jerry.
Yes.
Hello. Thank you very much for being here. It's wonderful to hear you, and this whole issue is becoming a passion with me. Claire, is deregulation where the government is not regulating? And what do you mean by contamination? Is one form of contamination when genetically modified pollen drifts over to, you know, a field that might have organically grown things? And aren't there petitions that people can sign and to get that we get labeling? I haven't heard of petitions around. And also from any of you, if there's websites that we can, you know, log on to or numbers to call to help any of these things.
There's a lot of information at True Food Now, I think it's called, and the Center for Food Safety. Either of those, they're mostly centerforfoodsafety.org or organicconsumers.org. Just about everything you want to, you could put in labeling or contamination, find out a lot of information that way. There are two kinds of contamination. One is basically where plants interbreed, where their related varieties interbreed. There's also genetic contamination where it happens what they call horizontally, and it gets in maybe the bacteria of the stomach of a bee and then is passed on to generations. They didn't think that was going to happen, but they're finding evidence that that happens. So there's a lot of science that's being done in other places. The fact that this government does not require those studies, or that industry is only required to tell the government what it wants to tell the government, means we're really lacking a lot of the information we need. But more and more in the last 10 years, there's a lot of good studies coming out. And if you want to see me afterwards, I'll be more than happy to, you know, guide you to a lot of those, specifically the studies. But some of those websites will give you just about everything you need.
And most people Thank don't you. Know the dangers. Like,
it's all there.
New viruses and bacteria can come.
That's right.
And,
okay, thank you.
And I was
Thanks.
Just wondering what water
I think we have to move on to our other questioners. We only have 5 more minutes.
And the mercury in these bulbs.
We'll talk outside. Yeah.
Hi, thanks for being here. I guess my question is somewhat related to the first, and it's mainly for Jerry, but for anyone else who'd like to respond.
Speak into the...
Okay. some environmental luminaries, and I'm thinking in particular of Amory Levins in his book Natural Capitalism, have said that the only answer is, or the only way we can move towards sustainability is not only with strict government regulations, but also by making conservation good for the bottom line in the private sector. And being as corporations are the main perpetrators of environmental degradation, do you think that that's a realistic vision? Do you think that there are economic models out there to make conservation good for corporations' bottom line in a significant way?
Well, I hate to say it, but and maybe there'll be disagreement on the panel about it, but I'm not optimistic about corporations on the whole making the kinds of decisions that would bring us out of this kind of crisis. I think the corporate model is one in which it requires growth and requires profits, and the corporation will make those kind of decisions wherever it can. Now, some corporations in certain kinds of industries and certain kind of activities will create businesses which are both green and profitable, and that's a good thing. And as much as possible, that should be encouraged. But I think to depend on that for the ultimate change that's required, I think is, in my opinion, it's not going to work out. I was on the board of a very well-known green corporation that I won't say its name because I like the people very much who owned it, and we had to make many decisions where you choose either saving the environment or profit, and it became very real to me because there were questions, for example, of whether to do a certain activity in a sustainable way, and they studied what the effect of on profits, and what I realized that was the three owners of this corporation, it was a privately held corporation, would actually lose at the end of the year about $5 or $6 million each if they made this sustainable choice. Now, actually, they did that in that case, but many other instances came up where they didn't do that because they weren't ready to make that kind of personal sacrifice. They were in business for a reason. And so this is a kind of a very difficult kind of question because we're depending right now on corporations for all of our needs, and I don't think that we can depend upon a system that bases itself upon growth and profit, that we can depend upon voluntarism in that area, in the corporate area, to make the kind of change that's required. I do think that we need systemic change.
Can I pick up on that just for 1 second? Because I really don't like to lay the blame all on corporations. And if you look at a report that came out this week by McKinsey & Company, it's a consulting firm, it says, you know, we have to take personal accountability for this. If we create the demand, businesses will respond to that. The individual consumer's choice is largely responsible for the environmental degradation that we're seeing today. Not so much industry, not so much anything else. It's our individual choices. Consumer products are the big problem coming out of China and all the environmental degradation there. So it's what we actually consume that actually causes a lot of environmental degradation. So we have to take personal accountability as well, not just lay it off on businesses.
Well, the truth is, I always think that there are three elements that control that. You've got the business leaders, and you've got elected officials, and then you have individuals. And all three of them operate as in shackles, that all three can only operate at the speed of the slowest one behind. But ultimately, it all boils down to individuals. I mean, business leaders, you'll see that the investments in green technologies and renewable businesses has grown exponentially over the last 5 years at a factor of over 200 to 300% per year. So there's a tremendous amount of influx of capital into those businesses now. With regulations, of course, is a way to remove the pressure of the CEOs and the business leaders, because ultimately they're in positions to make money, and the shareholders may have a green sensibility, but ultimately if the bottom line is not yielding the proper amount of capital on their investment, then they'll fire that CEO and get somebody else who's going to come in then and get in that kind of return. So it really takes a regulation, or at least some sort of incentive from government, in order to make that decision a little easier, to make that $5 million decision a year easier for a business leader. And ultimately, elected officials, I mean, this is a representational society. that we have. Our government ultimately is designed to represent our voice, but if we're not voicing our needs or our concerns, and of course the political leaders are not going to create the incentives, but there's always been great upheaval when the people have been shocked and have not been served. When that voice is being expressed, whether it's at the polls or through meeting a congressman and whatnot, there is a response because it is a representational government. And that's one of the things that's really important to remind is that all of us ultimately are individuals. We have a role to play, and that at the basis of this issue is our decision-making powers.
Well, and I'm reminded of a fact from Tom's book when he said he was talking about the pollution in Linfen City in China, and he said it was like a cloud cover with no end in sight. And he said a new coal plant gets built every 4 days in China, and that 35% of the carbon dioxide in China comes from manufacturing export goods to Western countries. So yeah. It's us as well. Yes.
Alexandra Post, the Alexis Group for Alternative Energy Finance, reinvigorating a food labeling regime called Food Tracer. And I've created a formula called R times T over P equals C. Resources times technology divided by population is average consumption. My question, going back to Sebastian's unique concern these days about population blast off, what can happen to stop that worldwide and also in this country where there's religions that believe in having big families? And secondly, how are we going to stop total encroachment on water and water loss from becoming massive desertification?
Well, in as far as populations, there's a basic regulation principle that is being enacted right now, and that's economy. I mean, the fact is that it's expensive to have children. There was a time when having children was, I mean, there still is by and large, but it's a celebration to bring a child in the world. Well, today you see in places like in Australia where they're implementing a carbon tax on each child, and every child beyond the first child gets taxed even further. I think that's a model that we're going to see develop in one form or another around the world. And the fact of the matter is it's expensive to have children, and if life becomes, if our disposable income or our standards of living are going to be lowered by the fact that we have more than...
That's the traditional argument, but the fact is, that's just one point. I heard the same argument at Stanford, and we've known it for decades.
Sure.
But the thing is, it's not working fast enough and strong enough, and we've got to do something about it fast. It's the economy argument, but it's the doctors that don't have children. The people that really don't need children or can't really afford to have them are having lots of them. So there's this dichotomy.
Thank you so much. We want to get to one more question before we wrap up, please.
Can I say a little something about water?
No, absolutely.
Oh, okay.
Yes, please.
Hi, my name is Lindsay Orwig, and I'm with Veg News Magazine. I just have a quick question for Mrs. Matheson. With your research on living more green, did you ever focus on the topic of vegetarianism and how it could help the environment?
Yes, actually. I think vegetarianism could help the environment. I mean, if the meat industry contributes something like 20% of fossil fuel emissions and that sort of thing. So it's seriously a problem. And Americans eat twice as much meat as the rest of the world does on average. So I think, though, we need to start with baby steps, and what I talk about in my book is eating less meat and talk about the impact of consumption and the fact that we just all need to start by cutting way, way back, and also making responsible choices when we do choose meat and looking instead of for meats that come from factory farms that are really the ones doing the polluting, but instead, when you do need to choose meat, going for farms that, do grass feeding and responsible farming, organic farming, that sort of thing. So,
thanks. Yeah. And yes on Prop 2.
Can I pick up on that? Yes. Maybe Claire, you want to say something about that, because there's a lot of water in vegetables.
That's true.
And are less water in vegetables than there is meat, so maybe you could help me out.
I don't know about that. Actually, what I was going to say about water was that, like seeds and healthcare, the other night in the debate, somebody brought up the commodification of the healthcare, and Barack Obama said health was a right. Water, access to clean, healthy water is a right. Mm-hmm. Clean, healthy food is a right. And it's the commodification of these things, right, Jerry, that has been plaguing us, I think, because we've economized rather than ecologized much of what is really basic in life. That's all I wanted to say about water, because I think, like water, just think of water, think seed, think food, you know, what kinds of food. Everything we've been talking about tonight, if we return it to that really basic relationship status of who we are in this world and what our right role with that is, things will start going better.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you all for your questions. We're going to we want to thank the organizers of LitQuake who brought us this environmentally friendly panel, and let's give the panelists a big hand for their thoughts. Now this meeting of Inforum and the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.